Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Genuine Chit Chat. This week I am joined by John Vespasian, the author of Undisrupted, as well as 9 other books. He's an avid historian, and he's got a lot of cool and interesting information to give. Now, a few quick highlights from the chat, as I don't want to get into too many details and bore you guys. Essentially, we speak about sort of John's books. He's written, as I said, 10 different books, all about sort of how to live your life using rational living, which is basically how he looks at history, biographies, as well as events and things, and uses them to sort of work out how best to live your life now. He explains it all with many examples, and it's all incredible stuff. He's a very, very well-read individual, and he's got a lot to say. So there's not only that, but he speaks about, you know, sort of traveling, why he wrote a book, why people should learn a second language. He speaks about future goals, career changes, and all those sorts of things. So even if you're not necessarily interested in changing your career or having a massive sort of change in sort of where your life is going, I really recommend people check this chat out, as obviously it's less than an hour long, and he's just got so many great nuggets of information, and at the very least, it'll make you think a lot. So that's what this chat is all about. Now, before the chat gets started, there will be a quick promo for the One Wear show. So there's a link to that in the description, as well as links to John's website and John's newest book on Amazon UK. You can find it on Amazon US and France, Spain, all these other places. But you can find links to anywhere that you need to go with John's books and etc. on his website. So that's it for me now, guys. Rambling at the start. I'll be back at the end of this chat to give insight on what's coming up next, as well as, you know, usual sort of jazz, follow on social media, review on iTunes, blah, blah, blah. So I'll be back at the end of the chat to give a bit more information on the show. A bit more of a ramble than the start of this. But yeah, I'm going to stop chatting now so you can get right into it. So, you know, thanks as always for listening. I appreciate all of you. And yeah, talk to you at the end.
Hi, my name is Nathan Gibbons. I'm a comedian from London. And about a year ago, I thought to myself, what is the world missing? What does society need more of desperately? And the answer is obviously another comedy podcast. So listen to my show, where I interview your next favorite comedians about themselves and the sitcom they either love or hate. It's called The One Wear Show. I mean, I bet you can't guess where I got that from, can you? And it's from Apple Podcasts. So it's The One Wear Show. I'm Nathan Gibbons. You are going to be my listeners. Thanks very much.
Welcome to Genuine Chit Chat, where we have honest conversations with interesting people. And I'm your host, Mike Burton. And I'm joined today by John Vespasian, and it's a great pleasure to be able to speak with you, John. I've been listening to a few podcasts that you've been on, and you've got some really, really interesting things to say that I think a lot of my listeners are going to really enjoy. So in brief, if you just want to kind of say who you are, essentially, and why we're chatting, really.
Yes, thanks for having me on, Mike. I've been writing books about personal development for 10 years now on one single subject, which is rational living. I explained this very briefly. What I'm doing is to go through hundreds of biographies, hundreds of stories from history, real people who've been very successful or very unsuccessful. And I'm trying to draw in each book principles and lessons from history that we can apply in our own lives in real time. So these are very practical lessons. The biographies I recount in the book, they are usually short. I really get to the point of each story. And each book is about a different aspect of rational living, whether it's how to do things in a certain sequence, how to organize yourself, how to develop your career. So the latest book is called Undisrupted. Undisrupted, how highly effective people deal with disruptions. And obviously, as the title says, it deals with how to deal with disruptions in life. And I've summarized in this book about 20 biographies of different people, different centuries, and trying to draw the principles that we can use today, even if some of the examples are from the Middle Ages, some of them are from ancient history. But I think the principles of human behavior, successful human behavior, do not change.
Well, that's a very good way of putting it. And yet you say the term rational living there, and I saw it sort of in a lot of your works and things. Obviously, that is the sort of main key thing. But when I was listening to another podcast you appeared on, and you had this really interesting story, which kind of, I think, helps people sort of understand it a little bit more. And I'd like to hear some more of them as well. But there was one specifically, which is about Howard Carter, the gentleman who sort of found Tutankhamun. And I wondered if you'd be willing to share that story again and kind of express, I know that, I think that was relating to like a sort of previous book, but the way you explained it and things, I really enjoyed, and I wondered if you'd be able to do that again.
Yeah, I think this story, I think I used it in one of my old books, maybe the first or the second. It shows very, I think, very clearly what's the difference between rational living and what today is so prevalent, which is this theory, this theory of what's called a law of attraction, positive thinking. I mean, this kind of stuff that today is almost religion. And what I present in my book is something completely different. I call it rational living because I emphasize the aspect of rationality, the aspect of trying to draw logical conclusions. Trying to be motivated, but not motivated foolishly, just by saying, I'm going to make it, that you see every day on TV, on movies. I find this subjective approach very unrealistic, very detrimental. Unfortunately, today is very prevalent. And I use the story of Howard Carter, who was an archaeologist, very famous in the 1920s, 1930s. And he was British. He didn't go to school. He was self-educated. He had some talent for drawing. And at a certain point, he got hired to go to Egypt in an expedition, a scientific expedition to make drawings and to make records from excavations. So he was drawing, learning about ancient Egypt. And he was a very curious guy. I mean, he was really willing to learn. He learned to read ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. He taught himself, actually, he read books. He was around with small jobs for a long time. And eventually, he developed the idea, which actually made him very famous and very wealthy, that there was the tomb, the remains, and the treasure of one pharaoh still undiscovered. And in the 1920s, you have to realize people have been digging in Egypt for centuries, for thousands of years. I mean, they have been robbers of tombs since the ancient Greek time. And it was a profession. I mean, people actually were digging every centimeter, trying to get all gold and all kind of treasures. And when Carter came in the 1920s with the theory that there is one missing, I made the check, I counted the pharaohs, there is one missing, and I'm going to find it. He was not a professor, he was not a doctor, he was not a historian, so people told him that he was crazy. And even if he had been working in the excavation business, so to speak, for more than a decade, he was just a guy who developed his own ideas and without any support from institutions, without any support from newspapers, from, I mean, he was basically alone. And the story is fascinating because eventually he found the tomb of Tutankhamun. He became very wealthy. He became world famous. He made a huge dent in the science of ancient Egypt. The idea is, how is it possible that this guy, who was making holes on the ground 14 years. I mean, after making holes on the ground 14 years, he didn't find anything until the very end when he was running out of money. And he managed to convince an English aristocrat to finance his excavations, to sponsor excavations. He managed to get a contract from the Egyptian government. Well, it was Egyptian. It was the French English government to get 50% of the foundings. And he managed to do this alone against massive criticism from newspapers. People were laughing at him. He was isolated. You have to realize it's a very miserable life. I mean, to be in the north or south of Egypt in the winter when it's very, very hot, it's really, I mean, you have to be super motivated. Imagine 14 years making holes on the ground and not finding anything. And he was motivating himself. And I found the story super interesting because the difference between this positive thinking that you hear every day in movies, on the radio, and on TV, the difference between this insane delusion and what Carter was doing in the 1920s is huge, because Carter had actually checked the sources. He had been checking the inscriptions on different temples, and he actually put together a theory that was based on facts. He was the only one who had managed to check different inscriptions in different parts of Egypt, and he actually counted the tombs that were found, and he came to the conclusion that was based on facts, there was one missing. Nobody had found it, but Carter was convinced that it was a great pharaoh, had a great fortune. He has to be somewhere. So eventually he developed a very scientific way to do it. He drew squares on a map, and he made every week about 1 meter. He was digging 1 meter per week. So he actually dug almost a whole valley. And eventually he found it at the very last minute. And the motivation that he was able to sustain 14 years is unbelievable. I mean, you have to realize it's like, I don't know, you want to do something and you work on your own 14 years and everybody's telling you, you're crazy, you're crazy, you're crazy. And then he eventually did it. And this is the kind of stories I find fascinating, because they're not based on delusion. They're not based on fantasy. It is based on facts. And Carter was able to sustain his motivation against the whole world and to convince a few people to support him, because he had the facts. And this is something that I underline in my books. You have to be motivated, you have to work, but you have to be rational. Because if you fall into the trap of positive thinking, law of attraction, and all this kind of nonsense, you might be going in the wrong direction for 14 years, and you will not realize, because you will have nothing to do with reality. It's just dreams. And the stories I present in the book underline that you have to be rational, you have to check the facts, and this is the way to become successful. Don't trust luck. Don't place your future in the hands of serendipity. Be rational, check the facts. I think this is something we have to learn from history.
Mm. You put that together expertly, and I completely agree with you. It is a lot of the, I think you mentioned it in previous podcasts as well, which is one of the issues with a lot of the time is just, you know, have a positive attitude and everything will just come to you, and write down your goals and everything will come to you. And it's like, well, there's so much more to it than just, you know, that sort of thing. And one thing that you actually mentioned, which I'm inclined to agree with actually, is you mentioned previously that you don't necessarily agree with people specifically writing down like goals, like people who are successful. So I wonder if you could sort of elaborate on your sort of thinking in that regard.
Yeah, this is another myth of contemporary psychology that encourages people to write the goals, to make a plan, a five-year plan, and to try to increase their results every week or every month. It's, I don't know, like preparing for a marathon, and then you check your performance every day and you try to reach the target. In most cases, people become demotivated after a certain time, because it's very difficult to have this kind of a straight line, 14 years, 20 years, 30 years, especially because when you're trying to develop a vision of what you want to do, and you are, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 years old, even 50 years old, for most people, it's very difficult to fix themselves on a specific goal, because you don't have enough information. If you like computers, for instance, or you like music, or you like whatever, theater, you have an idea of what you like. But whether you become an actor, a director, a producer, a literary agent, you don't know. You don't know, because until you get into the real business, you will not find the opportunity. You don't have the information. You might combine your interest in theater with music, and then you produce something else. I mean, you don't know, because you don't have the information. There is a learning curve. And what I've learned by studying this biography, history, in different books, is that most successful people, and successful in terms of not only money, but in terms of satisfaction with their profession, in terms of friendships, in terms of, I would say, general lifestyle, most successful people don't have specific goals. They have a very strong sense of direction. And they know what they like. I say, okay, I like theater, I like music, I like media, and I want to have my own show. They have an area of interest, which for most people is very obvious, because you know what you like, you know what you don't like. I mean, obviously, when you go to school and you hate mathematics, and next year you still hate mathematics, most likely you will not be very enthusiastic about engineering. And this is obvious, and then you have to find something else. But don't ask people who are 20 years old, 30 years old, to say, okay, what do you want to do exactly? Do you want to be the CEO of General Motors or I don't know, Apple, whatever? This is total nonsense. I mean, this approach of having very specific goals, to have a plan, very specific plan, is nonsense. Because most people don't have enough information. You learn as you go. What is very important, and you find in almost every successful career, is a sense of direction. To have an area of interest, to have curiosity for something, to have an attachment to a certain place, to a certain network of people, and eventually this becomes a business. Eventually this becomes a way of life. But I think that thinking in terms of specific goals for most people is a complete waste of time.
Yeah, and I think what you speak to there, especially for someone who's in my sort of generation, I mean, I'm 25 years old, so quite a lot of the younger ones. But and a lot of people I know, including myself, when we were in sort of college or any other education, it was never, oh, generally, where would you like to go? It was, what specific job do you want to do? I don't know. I don't even know. So at such a young age, especially, you have no idea what you want. And I know I've got older brothers who are like 20 years older than me and things like that. So I've interacted with quite a few people of varying ages throughout my life, not just as a child or an adult and things, but you know what I mean. And one thing that I found was there's people who are like 30, 40, even 50 years old who get to a point in their career and they're like, I don't want to do this anymore. This is never what I wanted to do. And they have a complete change of how, where they want to sort of go. And I think that what you're trying to sort of convey in both your writing and a lot of what you've been saying is obviously, yeah, go for what you like, have a sense of direction, walk in a general path, but don't beat yourself up if you don't have sort of the exact precise thing down, because it's ridiculous. And when you potentially fail, or if anything sort of slips up on the way to this really specific goal, it will only hurt your confidence, rather than if you have a general direction. If things don't go exactly as planned, you can kind of career adjust. You can sort of, the path that you're going on, you can adjust it to make sure you're kind of still on the path. But if you have one specific thing and you're rigid in that, then you're not going to achieve anything.
When you go through biographies of hundreds of people, you see the patterns. And okay, what you're saying is true to a certain extent, but when you see these people who are, I don't know, 50 or 40, and they want to do something else and they want to change, in most cases, it's very, very difficult to start from scratch and to do something completely different. And I think this is a rare case when you see successful people who are, I don't know, who are doing A, and then when they are 50, they start to do something completely unrelated, and they get into a different market and they become successful. This is so unusual that it could go into the front page of the newspapers, because it happens very, very seldom. What does happen very often is that people are using their skills or their interest in some area, and then they find another area where they can use the same skills. And this is something different. It's not that they throw everything away and say, oh, I'm going to be a new person. No. It's the same person. It's just finding a different market or a different application or a different speed or a different technology. Let me just give you an example from the latest book.
Please do.
I tell the story of Joseph Paxton, who was actually a British Englishman, a gardener, who eventually became an architect. And he designed the hall for the Great Exhibition. And to go from a gardener, I mean, the guy didn't even go to school. I mean, he started to work at 14 as an assistant gardener, and eventually he became a head gardener in a big, I think it was in near Manchester or something. I mean, it was quite a big estate, and he was planting trees and this kind of stuff. And how did this guy became a famous designer and architect, and he built country houses for the Rothschild family? How did he do it? Well, very, very slowly. He developed his skills as a gardener. He was very curious about learning. He read magazines, he learned all kinds of stuff, because he was ambitious, but he was not educated. He could not actually write very well. He also had a very strong accent. I would say low-class accent because he never went to school. But eventually, he started to experiment with glass houses, which was a big innovation in the 19th century. He built a small glass house in a garden. It was a disaster because it almost fell apart. But he learned a bit to put together glass panes with structures. And he built a bigger one and then a bigger one. And eventually, he was quite an expert in building glass houses. I mean, he didn't make a lot of money, but it was quite spectacular when people visited this estate. And in the winter, they have these big glass houses. They could take a walk inside. They had exotic plants. And when Paxton tried to develop his skills, it took him almost 20 years because he was trying to find an outlet for his skills. He tried to write articles for magazines. He started his own gardening magazine. He didn't make a lot of money. He tried to get a better job, and he couldn't manage. So he tried different things. And eventually, he saw an advertisement, a call for tender to build this building in London. It was in Hyde Park, because they wanted to have this exhibition. It was a Universal Exhibition. And they wanted to put up a building that was very light, has to be put together very quickly for a very low cost, and it has to be dismantled also very quickly. And there was this call for tender. Many architects sent designs, but they were too expensive or they were too slow. And then this gardener said, okay, maybe we can build a big glass house. I built already quite a number of glass houses. So he made a design and he wanted to send it. But he realized nobody was going to take him seriously because he was a gardener. And he did something very clever, combining his previous skills. Because he had been writing articles for newspapers about gardening in the Times, a few newspapers. So he knew a few editors. So he sent his design to the newspapers, his huge glass house. It was very cheap to build. And he also sent it to the call for tender. And since it has been published in newspapers, because they found it very weird, and people say, oh, this is really amazing. How could you build such a big, big house? So eventually they could not throw him out, even if he was a gardener, because the whole country was talking about it. And he actually got the contract. He had never built anything so big, but he got a contract. And he built it under budget. He built it ahead of time. He built it for 6 months. Eventually it was used for 40 years. I mean, it was the most profitable business possibly in the history of England. This guy, he was very creative. He was able to fix the leakages, because the problem with glass houses is that it's very difficult to prevent the rain from getting in, because you cannot really fit the glasses very, very easily to the structure. And he used putty that you use for putting together stones, but he used it for glasses very creatively, and he built it super quickly. I mean, the guy was really a genius of standardization. And after that, he became so famous that he got contracts for building country houses for the Rothschild family. So you see, he was using his skills in different areas, but he was always the same. He was a bit of gardening, a bit of glass houses, a bit of marketing, a bit of writing. And eventually he put it all together. And this is what I've seen in history. This is the best kind of careers. Because you just build, and eventually you take off. And he didn't take a lot of risk, because you have to realize that in the 19th century, if you lost your job, it was very difficult to get back on your feet, because you couldn't get the letter of introduction. I mean, it was really very formal. And this guy did it very carefully. He experimented here, he experimented there, and eventually got an opportunity. This is the best type of career. Even if you have to try different things for 10 years, it is very safe, it is very low cost, and it is very sustainable. You don't have to do crazy things. You don't have to quit your job overnight to start, some social media company, whatever. In history, this is the best example. Don't do crazy things just because you see it on the news. Because, yeah, some people can do that. They can quit the job and start a social media company. But the chances of success are very low.
Yeah, well, exactly that. And you know, sort of leading on from that sort of point, keeping in the same, obviously, sort of theme, I want to ask more specifically with your newest book. It's called Undisrupted. And I want to ask sort of a term that comes up, because I looked on it on a few websites and things, and I read some of the parts of it on Amazon, that sort of thing. And one thing that comes up is sort of the term of dealing with disruptions. And I wondered if you could sort of explain a little bit more of what you mean by sort of the disruptions, and also how one would sort of deal with them in a sense.
Yeah. The way I use the term disruption in the book is very wide. I am not talking about little things like, I don't know, you miss the train or something, which is, okay, nonsense. In the end, it doesn't have any impact, any long-term impact. I'm talking about big things. I mean, when people lose their jobs, they get a divorce, they fall severely sick, they have really to stop working. I mean, really big disruptions that in most cases can wipe you out. Huh? Some people really are completely destroyed when they cannot work, or they get very sick. So what I've done is to go through many biographies and to try to draw the principles, the patterns of people who do very well with disruptions. And I can tell you one of the principles. In the book, I present about 10 principles from different stories, from different examples. But there is a pattern that you see in almost every story, which is the following. People who do very well when they get disrupted, because in life, sooner or later, you get in trouble. I mean, could be a sickness, could be an accident. Maybe you are working very hard, but your company goes bankrupt. Anything could happen. And everybody is going to get, sooner or later, some major disruptions. People who do very well in times of disruption, you see the pattern in history. These are people who fall back on their key skills. They fall back on something they know very well. They fall back in a lifestyle that is working easily for them. They fall back on friendships they have for 20 years, 30 years. They fall back on a territory, on an area they know very well, and they can really survive there very easily. And you see the opposite pattern in people who destroy their lives. The book starts with an example of a great industrialist. His name was Sava Mamontov. He was a very famous industrialist in Russia in the early 20th century, late 19th century. And he was building railroads in Russia. It's a bit the greatest railroad investor in Russia before the revolution, before the communists. This guy was super intelligent. I mean, he could speak several languages, highly educated. He had studied in France, in the Sorbonne. He had developed almost from scratch a huge company and was building railroads from Moscow to the east. He made a fortune and he was a celebrity. It was like in the newspapers all the time. He had a great house in Moscow. He had a country house. He had a very large art collection. He destroyed his life within a year. And the story is very interesting because it shows the pattern of what you shouldn't do. And he had this big company with big success, and he got the idea, and you see this today very often when you see the news, that he wanted to do something else. He was a bit bored, maybe he was too successful. He wanted to do something else, and he started a steel mill. He wanted to produce steel for the railway because he was buying from someone else, but he wanted to do himself. He thought he could do anything. He was used to running a very large company, and he thought, okay, I mean, it has to be very easy to produce steel. Anybody can do it. He created a foundry, and he started to lose money very quickly. He didn't realize it was so complicated. It's not so, I mean, there are different technologies. He didn't know anything about steel. So he started to lose money very quickly after a year or so, and he was losing a large amount of money. And what did he do? And this is the fundamental mistake that people make when they deal with disruptions. Instead of saying, I made a mistake, I cut my losses. I close this horrible company and go back to my main business. I fall back on my skills. I fall back on my main business line. He made a fundamental mistake. He started to improvise. He started to get money from the railroad to pay for the losses of the steel mill. This was a huge mistake because his bondholders, his investors, immediately they found he was taking money from their pockets. They sued him, and he was prosecuted for embezzlement. Eventually, he didn't go to jail, but he lost everything. He lost his fortune. He lost his art collection. He lost his houses. And for the last 13 years of his life, he lived in total misery. His friends wouldn't talk to him. Nobody. I mean, he was really an outcast of society. He was a fall from grace. It was horrible. And you have to realize that this happens very often. And you see very often people who make a fortune as a Hollywood star. And then he uses the money he's investing in restaurants and he loses everything. And then you see this basketball player who makes also millions and then he invests in, I don't know, some stupid gold mine and he loses everything. This is a pattern you see in people who lose. The best way to deal with disruptions is to fall back on your basic skills. If you improvise, like Mamontov did in Russia, chances are you will lose everything because there is a learning curve for everything. And the most stupid mistake that we tend to do as human beings is to generalize and to say, oh, I can do A, automatically I can do B, and it's not true. There is a learning curve. And when you're in a state of crisis and when you're in panic and you have to deal with severe problems, with disruptions, do not improvise. Do not go through the learning curve. It's not the right moment. Fall back to your basic skills, to your basic friendships, to your basic profession, and you will do very well. You will recover. But if you improvise, you put the odds against you, most likely you will not make it. And I didn't find a single example in history where people do well by improvising. You could be lucky once in a while, but it's not a reliable strategy. And when you see these stupid movies, Hollywood movies, where you see these heroes who have no skills, they don't know how to fight, they have no military training, and they can do amazing things. I mean, this is so ridiculous and unrealistic that it's a shame. It's a shame because these are like stories for 5 years old. They are not credible. And it's a pity that we get this pattern of total fantasy day after day because it gives people a very unrealistic view of life. And this explains why so many people are depressed because they get this total fantasy idea that, okay, you can do anything without any training, without any preparation. You can improvise. Just do it. Just do it. And this is nonsense. So what I try to do in my books is to make people a little bit more rational, a little bit more realistic, because it works to their advantage.
Mm. And I think what you do with your books is obviously the way that you intertwine, you know, rational thinking and things along with all the lessons from history is, I mean, I'm not sure that I've seen anyone actually do that before in this sort of part of the sort of genre of writing that you're sort of inside. So what I want to ask is, was there like a specific moment that made you realize I need to start writing books? Because I think Undisrupted was your 10th book, if I'm correct. So obviously when you wrote your first book, then was there like a moment that made you realize you sort of, no one had kind of connected the dots like you had?
It was a process. It's not an overnight decision. But I remember distinctly when I wrote my first book, and I did it over a holiday. I think it was a 4-week period. And I was particularly frustrated because I always been reading, a lot. I'm a voracious reader for years. And at a certain point, I was very frustrated with the kind of books I could find because I read a lot about marketing, finance, personal development, philosophy. I have to say, most books you find in the market, they are so unrealistic that they piss me off. They're so superficial, fluffy, delusional. that at a certain point I thought, okay, maybe I can do something better because this is really pathetic and you cannot really find alternatives. It's like a trend that completely dominates the market. People like to read it, but it's a bit like a drug because they preach fantasy, I don't know, magic and this kind of stuff. And in the end, of course, they don't work because it's pure nonsense, but it's like, I don't know, cocaine or it's a drug. And I started to write books, I have to say, out of pure frustration because I could not find the kind of books I wanted to read. Very factual, based on history, based on common sense, based on principles, and above all, based on reason. Because I tell you, the amount of nonsense you see in these books about psychology and personal development is astonishing. I mean, people are so unrealistic, and they take a personal anecdote that is completely meaningless, and they try to blow this up into a huge theory of the universe. I mean, it's nonsense. So what I'm trying to do to a modest extent is to try to show people that if you become a little bit more rational, I mean, you don't have to become a robot, just to become 1%, 2% more rational, to try to be a little bit more thoughtful in your decisions, it makes a huge difference in the long term because you make every day your life a little bit better with little things. Could be your habits, your nutrition habits, could be your sports habits, could be whatever. You improve a little bit every day, every week. In 10, 20 years, the difference will be huge. And it's difficult to internalize the long-term consequences of little things. Like, I don't know, imagine that instead of drinking soda, some people are completely addicted to drinking sugar drinks, these carbonated drinks. Instead of drinking these sodas, you just drink herbal tea. I mean, it's a very simple habit. If you go into history, which is one of the patterns I really go into my books about ancient medicine, I find very interesting to see how people stayed healthy in ancient Rome and ancient Greece, where the technology was low, but they knew a lot about habits, about really staying healthy, and people actually lived quite long if they didn't get killed in war. But you see these philosophers, Aristotle, Plato, I mean, they actually grew very old in their 80s, 90s. It's astonishing. And you see the habits. And the question I mentioned is just the herbal tea. This is something you find it in Hippocrates, you find it in Galen, you find it in different writings from 2,000 years ago, or 25 centuries, some of them. It's a very simple habit. But to get into your head that you just quit drinking sodas and you start drinking herbal tea, it will change your life. Eventually, it will have a big impact. But to actually grasp the consequences is not easy because it's a long-term consequence. It is something that it looks like a little thing, but it's not a little thing. And this is what I try to explain in my books. To be a little bit more rational. You don't have to become a robot. You don't have to become a computer. Just be a little bit more rational. It will make a huge difference.
Yeah, and you know, that's something that I think a lot of people can get behind because they find that, you know, a lot, as you rightly said, you know, a lot of these books, you go into it and it says, okay, change every aspect of your life immediately, just, you know, throw all these things away and write a giant big thing and make a giant plan of everything you want to do and then do everything you can. And it can become so overwhelming, especially for people who, if you want to change your life and if you're unhappy, then doing an absolutely gigantic change can be such a big thing to do, that doing these sort of small incremental changes one at a time, in a sense, it makes it not seem like you're doing anything. But as you've rightly stated, they have such big ripples and consequences that they can really change someone's life for the better. And what I want to ask you about a little bit is as well, I'm aware that you've sort of, obviously you're very well read, as you've rightly pointed out. You've had a lot of experience sort of traveling the world. I just want to touch on that just a little bit. I want to ask sort of where you've been across the world, because obviously I think you're from the Netherlands, if that's correct.
Yeah, okay. I lived in France, in Spain, Germany. I visited Russia in the last years a couple of times, which is super interesting. I think most people have a very weird idea about Russia. They should actually go and take a look, because it's fascinating and it's very, very close by. I mean, it's a flight of 3 hours. I've been a few times in the US, but mostly I'm European. So Europe I know pretty well. I've been around, especially Southern Europe, very, very often in different countries. And I think people should actually travel more and learn other languages. And this is something that I preach in every, almost every interview, every podcast, to say, come on, learn the second language. It's so easy to learn Spanish or to learn French or to learn German. It's very easy and it's very inexpensive. I mean, you can learn almost for free. You get the PDF for free on internet. You get courses on YouTube. It's very easy to learn the second language. The problem, again, is that it's going to take you some time. It's going to take you, maybe you spend 10 minutes a day, just 10 minutes a day. Everybody can spare 10 minutes a day. After 3 years, you will speak French, you will speak German, or you will speak Russian, whatever. And it will make a difference in your life. You cannot realize the number of opportunities that are going to open. Many things that you cannot see because they're in a different language. And this happens very often when people look, I mean, imagine you look at something written in German and you don't speak German. Automatically, your brain stops. You just say, okay, it's German. I don't understand. I don't know what it is. Or Russian. From the moment you start to understand, or French, which is very close. I mean, come on, France is next to the UK. I mean, you could learn French. You could learn French relatively easy. I mean, you can travel to France for, I don't know, £40 or something. I mean, it's ridiculously cheap, but it takes effort. And what it really takes effort is the motivation, because it's something that's not short term. It's going to make a big difference in your life. You will enjoy life more because you will see different cultural experiences, like going to Paris or going to the south of France and speaking actually French and being able to understand many things. It will enrich your life. I think it will also make you better in your profession. It will make you certainly, if you invest money, a better investor, because you will have more information. And the investment of time and money is very low. I mean, people cannot realize you can learn the second language almost for free. Now, instead of listening to, I don't know, to music in the car when you're commuting, put a CD and learn some French, learn some Spanish. It's very easy to learn Spanish. It's a very easy language. It will make a difference in your life. But still, I understand that people are skeptical. Oh, it's very difficult. I will never make it. No, it is not true. People were learning languages in the 19th century. You have to realize, one of my books is about Schliemann, who was an archaeologist. He was learning himself languages. He developed a method to learn languages in the 19th century without any help. And eventually he was able to speak seven languages fluently. He was a guy without any education. He had to quit school when he was 8 years old. And it is possible. I mean, people have been doing this for centuries. The problem is that we get used to this short-term satisfaction. The Twitter, the Facebook, the likes, the, I don't know, whatever, which is a drag. It's excitement minute by minute. And to read a book, to relearn a different language, to get a qualification as an engineer or accountant. It takes effort. It takes a few years, but the enrichment of your life will be huge, especially when the investment is so low. You don't realize how cheap it is, how easy it is to learn the second language if you put every day 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, my partner, Megan, she's been on the podcast before. She's actually a languages teacher and she speaks four languages. Her dad's side of the family is Italian. So she speaks all these languages. And at the moment, I only speak like a little bit of French and a tiny bit of everything else. And I'm trying to learn Italian. And that's basically, she said to me, she said, little and often, just, you know, don't sit there and spend 8 hours trying to learn Italian because nothing's going to go in. But if you every day learn a little bit piece by piece, eventually it will work. And I've heard that so many benefits of speaking other languages, of course, what you've stated, and, you know, going to other places and learning about other cultures, but it also changes the brain chemistry. It literally changes how you sort of learn and think and things, and it can be so beneficial, especially for children. And I know we're sort of getting towards the end of the time, so I won't keep you too much longer, but I did want to ask as well. Obviously, you're so into history and things, and you know so many incredibly interesting stories. Is there like a specific time period that you love more than any, that really calls out to you, that you just can't get enough of?
Well, certainly the 19th century, I think, is fascinating because there were no borders. When you see, we are talking about the period until the First World War, 19th century. I mean, you have to realize, you read, for instance, the biography of Agatha Christie, the mystery writer. I mean, she was traveling to Egypt. She was traveling to Iraq. She was traveling to Mesopotamia. Because her husband was an archaeologist, and she was traveling around. I mean, come on, there were no borders. People carried the passport. There were no visas. It was super easy. I find this fascinating because now people are terrorized about immigration, and it seems to be that there is a paranoia. Oh my God, they're coming here, that taking away their jobs. I mean, you have to realize that until very recently, this was seen as an enrichment. That people come from other countries, they bring their skills, they bring their motivation, they create wealth, they increase standard of living. And this is the case for centuries. This is one of the keys of the prosperity of the US and Europe. There was a lot of immigration. People went there highly motivated to start a business, to start a new life, to get things better. And now we are terrorized. In the 21st century, it seems that we get a guy from across the border or from a different city. I mean, it's like a threat, and he's going to destroy our livelihood. And it is complete nonsense. I mean, we have gone down intellectually in this respect. It is deplorable. So I find the 19th century fascinating because you see people from different countries moving. You see many Russians living in Paris and many Europeans going to Russia. It was, at that time, it was a normal European country. And you see this mentality of trading, investing, having houses in different countries. It was normal. Now it is becoming like, I don't know, like paranoia to deal with foreigners. I think we have the love to learn from the 19th century, especially this vision of individual freedom. I think people today, for lack of historical knowledge, they are becoming very narrow-minded, very fearful of change, and they don't realize that without freedom, without traveling, without an influx of motivation from different countries, different people, we become stagnant. We become a dying culture, a dying continent. And this is the last thing we want. We want to continue to grow. We want to have innovation. We want to have better opportunities. And we should not be fearful of traveling or of people coming looking for a better job. It is normal. It has always happened in history, and this is one of the keys to prosperity.
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more on that point. I mean, traveling is one of those things I've always said to people, is that you need to go out and experience, not just for other people's cultures and that sort of thing, but it's like a breath of fresh air for your mind and your body. It's incredible when you go to so many different countries that, you know, we're all people at the end of the day, but how just slight differences can make such beautiful works of art and incredible architecture. I mean, my favorite thing is architecture. I love churches and mosques and castles and all that sort of other stuff. So some of the things that you can see, that there's something for everyone if you travel. And I agree with you with the immigration thing. You know, some of the greatest countries are the greatest countries, air quotes, greatest countries, because of the culmination of different cultures coming together and getting the best of all the different cultures rising up and making something better than the sum of their individual parts. And I want to ask as well, briefly, are you optimistic for the future, or do you think it's going to get better before it gets worse, or just generally, what do you think is sort of going to happen with society as such a massive historian?
Yeah, I'm very optimistic, and I think it's not wishful thinking, it's not delusion. When you read the newspapers every day, it's easy to become depressed because you see all kind of nonsense and people making stupid decisions. But if you look at the big picture, it's very positive. You see the number of people creating companies today, not only in the US and Europe, everywhere. People, they create internet companies in Latvia, in China, in South America, with a very low investment, and sometimes they become very successful. And this spirit of entrepreneurship, I think now is universal. It used to be something that you had only in the US and Europe and maybe Australia. Now you have it in Korea, you have it in Japan, you have it in India. This is a very positive trend. It's a trend which is not reported everyday newspapers, but I think it's a change of conscience in humanity. People realize they have to create things, they have to produce, they have to become self-reliant. And this makes me very optimistic because I think the trend cannot be changed. Even in countries that are authoritarian, that people are looking for freedom, you still have this entrepreneurial spirit in a great part of the population. Because they watch TV, they watch news, they realize that the only way to progress is by creating companies, by creating jobs, by producing. And this is not going to change. I think it's something that in history people have changed. They have realized you cannot create prosperity just by complaining. You have to actually do something. You have to create. Maybe it's a little thing. Maybe you just do whatever. I mean, just a little thing every day. But the mentality of entrepreneurship, the mentality of production, of innovation, of taking initiative, I think is now widespread in most countries. Some people have, of course, stupid ideas about economics, but okay, this has always happened in history. But what we have in the 20th century is thousands and thousands of people starting new companies, incorporating companies for a very low investment. I don't think this is going to change. This trend is most well established. It is more solid than any bad news you can find on the front page of the newspapers today. It's a very solid historical trend. It is unreported, but it makes me very optimistic. I think that the level of entrepreneurship in the next century, in the next decades, will continue to grow. It will solve problems that nowadays with people become hysterical about the environment and whatever. They will solve problems. They will find entrepreneurial solutions. They will find business solutions to solve problems about pollution, problems about emissions, whatever. Businessmen, entrepreneurs will find solutions. This makes me very optimistic. And I think we should look at the big picture and to try to remain motivated every day and not pay too much attention to the daily nonsense we see on the news.
I completely agree with you there, and I'm very happy to hear someone who's as well read and as clearly as intelligent as yourself is also optimistic. I generally am optimistic as well. People do piss me off quite a lot, but generally I try and see the good in people and the positives that's going on. So it's really good to hear someone as well read as yourself expressing a similar opinion. And just before I let you go, I'll make sure that I include sort of a link to your website and all any of the things that you wish in the description, so people can come and find your work and things. But I thought, as we come to the end here, sort of your final word, something that you just want to sort of tell any of the listeners, it can be about yourself, the world, or anything at all, just before we sort of close up.
Yeah, if you pick up one idea from the interview today, I would like just to remember this thing. When you have to make decisions in life, when you have to see what you're going to do and you don't know exactly what to do and you are confused and you are sometimes depressed because you are experiencing a setback, you have to take the right perspective. And the right perspective is to think in terms of a lifetime. This is something I underline in my books. Don't think in a short period and you think for next week and the next month, because you might become very depressed if you are going through a bad period. If you lose your job and then say, oh, I lost my job, what am I going to do? And then people become almost suicidal. It's ridiculous. But if you think in terms of a lifetime, you're going to live 80, 90, maybe 100 years, maybe even longer. The fact that you lose your job or you get an accident and then you have to stay home for, 2 months, it will have zero impact long term. If you think in terms of 90 years, in terms of 95 years, and this is the right perspective. You don't need to think in terms of centuries, which is irrational. You don't need to think in terms of days, which is irrelevant. Try to think in terms of a lifetime, and it will make it very easy for you to make good decisions, because you will see yourself in the next decade. Okay, I'm going to become then 40 and then 50 and then 60 and then 70. And I want to have a path which is consistent, which is growing, which is making me happy. If you take this perspective, you will become more rational automatically, and you will make better decisions. And this is one of the lines, the main lines of thought I underline in my books. Try to think in terms of a lifetime, and you will improve your life substantially.
Well, John, well, that is absolutely incredible. And I really thank you for taking the time out of your day to sort of come on the show and speak with me about these sort of things. You've just in this podcast alone, you've given out such a great amount of historical information and also just general life advice that it really backs up the fact that people need to go check out your books and things. And it's really good to have people like you in the world who are, as I say, just so well-read and have a different perspective due to the sheer amount of history and knowledge and the passion that you have for all of this, and that you want to turn it and help people with it. And I just think that's incredible. So I just want to, you know, thank you not only for coming on the show, but also thank you for all that your work. And I hope that you continue to do it for decades to come.
Many thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, John. I hope you have a great day.
Okay, bye.
And that's the end of the podcast. Thanks as always for tuning in, guys. As I said in the intro, John Vespasian's site, as well as a link to his book on the UK Amazon, are in the description, and the book is available everywhere, so be sure to check that out. Coming up, I've got two chats recorded with some very interesting individuals. I spoke about one a couple weeks ago or last week, which is Tracy Maxfield. She's another author, and her whole thing is about basically mental health in schools, especially, and bullying and that sort of thing. So that's one of the episodes that's going to be coming out in the next few weeks. I've also got a chat, which is a longer chat. It's going to be another two-parter with Maxwell Ivy. He's also known as the blind blogger. He's a gentleman who lost his sight, where he started to lose his sight around the age of 12. I think by the age of 20, he'd basically completely lost his sight, but like a very small amount. And it's sort of, he talks about what happened to him, what his life was like before and after and things. But it sounds like quite a dour chat, but he's such a nice and funny guy. He's really optimistic and things, which obviously one would assume if someone who's been dealt with that kind of cards in life, sort of, that you'd have to do that to get through it. But it's quite interesting where the other individual who I've had on the podcast, called Goff of Beer Nuts Productions, who's been on the show twice, who's also a blind individual, both him and Maxwell both are just so inspiring, not just in a sense of, you know, they've got through a lot and that sort of stuff, but just talking to them, they're so fun and seemingly easygoing and just really funny people as well, that it's inspirational in the way that you wouldn't necessarily expect. So I may be releasing that one next week. I'm not 100% sure. I haven't really decided yet, as I normally don't really decide these things until the Saturday before. So we'll see which one of those two comes out. I've got a few more recordings in the works. At the end of February, I've actually got, Megan's away for like 5 days. So I've got three different podcasts recorded. One of them I can talk about because he will probably want me to, which is Goff of Beer Nuts Productions, funnily enough. He's got another film coming out, so he's coming back for another chat, which it's always great to chat with Goff as well. And the other two, one of them's with a podcast that I always talk about on social media and I'm always sort of hyping up. So I'm going to hopefully have the guys from that on there. That's enough of a hint. You may be able to get it, but you may not. So I can't wait to speak with those guys. And then I've got another gentleman who's coming on who's just someone who's like a professional, someone who's really interesting and talking about cybersecurity and things. So I'm quite interested in that sort of realm as well. So quite a nice variety of things coming up. I think I've got another podcast recording soon, but fortunately the ones I've got at present are enough to last me until that February weekend. So it might be the Maxwell and the Tracy ones coming on after this episode in the coming weeks, maybe the only ones before the three that I'm recording, but I don't know. I'm trying not to record or even plan too far ahead because I end up shooting myself in the foot when doing that. So that's kind of what you got coming up. As well, I've still got that thing that I can't fully talk about. I kind of can. It's going to be to do with Comics in Motion. So I'm going to be doing something with them that's really cool and exciting. Once I've figured out more information about it and spoken with Chris and Dave about it a bit more, then there'll be more information on that. I'm also due, I think there's two other podcasts who want me to go on their shows and speak to them, but we haven't quite got a date for those yet, so that'll be a thing. As well as, there's lots of other things in the pipeline and stuff. So, you know, I still want to get Reese on the podcast again at some point soon, so I don't know when I'm going to do that. I don't know. there's a lot of things that, you know, there's a lot of people I know who are very, very interesting, far more interesting than I am, who I want to have on the show, and lots of other people who have been contacting me or want to chat with me as well. So all I can say is thanks to everyone listening, especially you, you beautiful person. And if there's more than one of you listening at once in a car or something, then you're all beautiful people, even if you're being forced to listen to this by someone else, in which case, sorry, it's almost over. I will say what I always say, basically. I'm on the usual social media channels, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Twitter, I share a lot of other people's stuff. Facebook is mainly just the posts about new episodes and the film reviews I occasionally do. And then Instagram is basically everything. It's got snippets from episodes, sometimes photos that go along with it. I've got film reviews, stuff that I generally do. I try and occasionally do T-shirt Tuesday, which it's more just me taking a photo of a T-shirt I really like and posting about it. So I occasionally do that. I've managed to do it twice in a row now. I used to do it quite a lot last year, but it's just when life gets busy, it's harder to do that. I've seen quite a few films recently that I need to write reviews for, as well as TV series. Obviously, The Good Place finished recently as well, so I need to get off my ass and write a review about that. So there's lots of things I need to do. I just don't have enough time in the day to do most of them. So, you know, that's what's going on with me, social media wise. And I also appreciate anyone reviewing the show. You know, there's iTunes. I think Google Podcasts has got reviews on that as well. I think Stitcher does as well. Even Facebook, you know, anyone who likes my show, if you write a review, I will really, really appreciate it. If you don't want to write a review for any reason, that's fine. If you do share this either via word of mouth or on social media or anything like that, it really, really means a lot to me, because I don't spend any money on ads, because that stuff is expensive and doesn't seem to really do anything, because I have tried that before. But anyway, I'm going to stop rambling. Thanks to each and every one of you for listening. I do really, really appreciate it. And I'm going to go now, because it's a Sunday night and I'm quite hungry for dinner. So I'll talk to all you guys next week.